Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Your flight to Bristol has been delayed once again. For your entertainment purposes, please listen to the Baggage Claim Monday edition of the Baseball Tonight podcast with Buster Olney. The White Zone is for immediate unloading and loading of passengers only. No parking in the White Zone.
Yep, a Baggage Claim Monday, September 16, 2019. I'm Buster Olney. Back in Bristol is Troy Farkas. And Troy, this isn't like a lot of other Baggage Claim Mondays. We had the Sunday night game last night at Citi Field, and then I had the nice leisurely drive. I was home by 11:15 last night, so I'm in a very good mood this morning. How are you doing? How was your weekend?
That's what I like to hear. Good home game for you. I'm doing great this weekend. I am very excited by what's going on in baseball, football as well, but it's still baseball season, so I'm still dialed into that.
How's the friend zone situation going?
It reached an apex this weekend. I'll have to tell you about it off air.
Wow. Now there's a tease that we're not going to get to, unfortunately. Now I have to go through the highlights quickly so I can hear the story off air. All right. Yesterday we got news. Bad news for the Angels. Mike Trout is set for his second foot surgery of the month. He is going to have removal of Morton's neuroma, a painful condition affecting the ball of his foot. Mike Trout, down about the situation, obviously, talked to reporters on Sunday.
It just didn't get better. It's been the same for, a couple weeks now. So, tried injections, tried, the cryoablation or however you even say it. I thought that would help. But, as soon as I went out there, started running, when it flares up, after it flares up, in about 30, 40 minutes, it just, it's tough to walk on. And, it's just battling every day, trying to get it right and, trying to convince myself to come in and tell myself that it's going to be good. And, I start running and it's sore. So
it's been probably one of my craziest, for sure. Tyler passing. It's been tough for the team emotionally. We've been through a lot. It was just a tough year for us.
And obviously there's going to be a question about how Trout's injury and his absence will affect the MVP voting in the American League. We'll be talking with Tim Kirchen about that. Trout's had just 20 plate appearances in the month of September. The Angels played the Rays, who are trying to get a grip on an American League wild card spot. And Albert Pujols continues to make progress in a home run chase.
So 2-1 the count on Albert with Cole Calhoun waiting on deck. And the next pitch, that ball's lifted high, and that ball's blasted out into left field. It's out of here! Albert's having a big day for the Angels. He just clubbed a three-run homer, and the Angels have busted this game open and lead it 6-1.
Terry Smith, Angels Radio, AM 830 for Albert Pujols, 656 career homers. Willie Mays, of course, 660 in his career. On Saturday, the Twins swept the Indians in a doubleheader. On Sunday, the Indians salvaged a game with help from Roberto Perez.
He delivers, and it's hit a ton! Deep right center! Forget about it! And the Indians are back on top, 5-4! Oh, what a majestic blast to right center!
I love that home run call from the great Tom Hamilton, WTAM 1100. And after Cleveland's 7-5 victory on Sunday, the Indians down behind the Twins in the American League Central by 5 games in the loss column, but they are in the thick of the wild card race. And Terry Francona talked about the rest of the season ahead.
I'd like to see them have a good off day tomorrow because they deserve it. And then we'll see if we can beat Detroit on Tuesday. That's the best way to go about it. In the meantime, we'll probably, hope some teams lose. But I haven't figured out how to control that yet.
Terry Francona with his dry sense of humor. We've got the Indians and the Phillies on Sunday Night Baseball next weekend in Cleveland. The A's and the Rangers. Oakland is making a late season push. How about Sean Manaea? Tremendous again. 6 scoreless innings, and he got support from Marcus Semien.
Here's the righty's offer. It swung on and hit the deep center. On the run is Heidemann to the track at the wall, and out it goes. Marcus Semien, his 30th home run. What a season for the A's shortstop with Grossman aboard. And the A's strike first to make it 2-0 as he ties the all-time home run record for the A's set back in 1996 with blast number 244.
Vince Catrone, 860 AM. The answer, the final score there again was 6-1. The Yankees trying to win the best record in the American League. They faced the Blue Jays on Sunday, but Randall Grichuk got a big hit against them.
And the 1-1. Swing a high fly ball. You can forget it. That ball is going to go a long way and into the 200 level. Second bomb of the day for Randall Grichuk. An absolute no-doubter. Three-run shot for Grichuk.
That from Sportsnet 590, the fan. The Blue Jays win 6-4 in this game. Dellin Betances made his return to the mound for the Yankees, his first appearance in 2019. The Astros faced the Royals, and Josh Reddick had himself a day.
Reddick drives one deep to right field. This ball is gone. Josh Reddick hits a two-run home run. And the Astros now lead 7-1. Reddick is 3-for-3 today and hits his 13th home run of the year.
Todd Callis and the Astros television network. Reddick would finish the day with 5 hits, and the Astros and the Yankees would finish the day with identical 98-53 records. But remember, Houston owns the tiebreaker against the Yankees, so Houston ahead right now in the race for the number one seed in baseball. The Brewers and the Cardinals, this was a crazy game. In the bottom of the seventh inning, the Cardinals took the lead.
And there's a long drive down the left field line to the corner. It's a home run. Paul DeJong with a home run just inside the pole. And the Cardinals go back in front 3-2.
John Rooney on the Cardinals radio network. It was 4-3. Top of the ninth inning, Brewers on the edge, bases loaded, full count, two outs on Ryan Braun.
High drive, deep left center field, Bader is back, Braun, a grand slam, and the Brewers have taken the lead in the ninth on a Ryan Braun slam. Holy cow, what a shot by Braun.
That from 620 WTMJ, Troy. How about the Brewers' response since Christian Yelich went down? They're finding a way, it feels like, every day.
It's been pretty amazing. And, you know, yep. Buster, I really want to see an Indians-Brewers World Series so we can have Tom Hamilton versus Bob Uecker.
Maybe we could have them on the podcast together. Absolutely. That would be fun. All right, the Phillies trying to hang in there in the National League wildcard race. They faced the Red Sox, and it was not a good day for Philadelphia.
Here's his 67th pitch. And a swing and a drive hit hard to left field. Going back on the play, Miller looks up, and that ball is gone, a home run. It's a grand slam for Christian Vasquez. A line drive homer to left. And it's 5-1 Red Sox.
Mario Pemba, WEI 93.7 FM. That was in the third inning. In the fourth inning, Gabe Kapler, Bryce Harper ejected for arguing balls and strikes. Boston wins 6-3. The Nationals and the Braves. And Yan Gomes got a big hit for the Nationals in the second inning.
Now the set of the pitch. Swing and a ground ball right side. May get through. It does. Under the thigh of the elbow. He's in a right of base hit. Hendricks scores from third. Robles on his way to the plate. Scores standing. On a C.I. ground ball single through the right side for Yan Gomes. RBIs 36 and 37. And the Nationals break out on top first. Here in the bottom of the second inning.
Charlie Slows on the Nationals radio network. The Nationals won 7-0. Scary moment in this series that we're going to talk about coming up with Tim Kirkton. Charlie Culberson of the Braves being hit in the face by a pitch. The Reds and the Diamondbacks. Trevor Bauer was excellent on the mound. 9 strikeouts in 8 innings, and he got support from a teammate who's climbing to the top of the home run leaderboard.
And a payoff pitch coming. And that one is another one. There it goes. Long and deep into left center. And he has tied a major league record. Second home run of the game for A. Eugenio Suarez, number 47 on the year. Run batted in number 100. He has tied Andres Galarraga. Reds lead it 3-1.
That was a Hall of Famer. Marty Brenneman, 700 WLW. The Reds, the final score was 3-1. Yes, Suarez now tied with Pete Alonso of the Mets for the most home runs in the big leagues. The Cubs and the Pirates. And in the top of the third inning, a really scary moment for the Cubs.
He is in a lot of pain.
Yeah, I don't want to guess, but it looked like he rolled his ankle pretty bad. And sometimes that can really hurt initially, and then it kind of calms down. That's what we hope, because there's a whole lot going on there. And so how much that turned in.
Yeah, that was Len Casper, Jim DeShays. You can hear them reacting to the replays of what it looked like Rizzo turning his ankle. It was ugly. He could put no weight on his foot as he was helped off the field. We don't know exactly how long he's going to be out, but this is potentially a devastating injury for the Cubs. But they would come back in the bottom of the third inning of this game.
The 0-1, Kemp lines one, base hit, right field down the line. It's going to drive in a run. Here comes Zobrist. Here comes Hayward behind him. Two runs are going to score. Kemp going to third. He's got a triple. Cubs lead 7-5.
After the Cubs' 16-6 victory over Pittsburgh, Joe Maddon talked about Rizzo.
No different than Yelich being lost to the Brewers. I mean, stuff happens, man. You just got to keep moving it forward. We'll wait and see how it plays out. Hopefully, there's a potential that it's not going to be that long. Just remain optimistic and see what they say tomorrow. Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, from the fans' perspective, it is what it is. I mean, you're going to be devastated by that. We are too, to a certain extent. Then you got to move it forward, man. You know, we're missing Javi right now. We miss Contreras for a large part of the season, and now you know, KB's been in and out, etc. Zobrist was not even here, so we're used to this in a sense, and. And the depth has got to pick us up. I got to figure out tomorrow's lineup at first base for Gray tomorrow, right? So I got to take a look at that.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
Game of the day at Citi Field. The Dodgers and the Mets, the final game of a three-game set. The Dodgers had won the first game. The Mets had won the second game. The Mets hanging by their fingernails in the race for the second wild card. And it was going well early against Walker Buehler.
Buehler sets and fires. Swing and a liner. Fair ball down the right field line. And it's going to get into the corner. Cano in to score. They're going to wave Davis. Nimmo speeding for third. Throw to the plate. Too late. Nimmo in to third. It's a two-run triple for Brandon Nimmo on the 10th pitch of the at-bat. 2-0 Mets.
Boog Sciambi, the legend on ESPN Radio. Great at-bats for the Mets. And Zach Wheeler was great. 7 innings. One run allowed. The Mets turn it over to the bullpen, which has been their problem area all year. And right away, Justin Wilson issued a walk. There was a balk. There was a wild pitch. And then this happened.
And the 2-1. Swing and a ball driven out towards right center field. Well struck. That one back there. That one's off the fence. In to score comes Jerko. Taylor into second. And we're starting over. It's a 2-2 game.
And Seth Lugo came into the game and cleaned up the 8th inning for the Mets. He was still on the mound in the 9th inning when this happened.
The pitch. Swing and a ground ball. Base hit up the middle. Racing around third is Kike Hernandez. Jed Jerko delivers with a huge RBI single in the 9th. And the Dodgers have taken a 3-2 lead.
And that would be the final score, and that might be it for the Mets. They're now 4 games behind the Cubs in the race for the second wild card. According to Fangraphs, their chances for making the postseason at this point, 8%, the Cubs at 73%, Cardinals at 86%, Nationals 96%. We'll be talking with Tim Kirchner in a moment, but before that, do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. The real question is, how easy would it be if those ticketing sites actually cared? With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? A quick look at the App Store shows over 50,000 five-star reviews. And it's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map. SeatGeek breaks down the details. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. And Troy, Friday night, I was at Fenway Park. I saw The Who with tickets that I bought on SeatGeek. What an incredible experience. It was easy, the process of getting the tickets, and what a concert.
I need to see some photos, Buster. Were you turnt, as the kids say?
I'm telling you. I will send you the photo. We got a lot to talk about off air, I'm telling you. It was an amazing experience. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code Buster for $10 off on your first purchase. That's promo code Buster for $10 off on your first purchase.
Seam heads rejoice.
Nerd alert!
It's Timmy time.
Is this a great game or what?
With Tim Kirkchian on Baseball Tonight.
Tim Kirkchian covers baseball for ESPN, which means traveling like crazy. Tim, where are you this morning?
I'm at the airport Sheraton here in Hartford. I did a wise move. Instead of driving like a madman to get to the airport this morning, I came here last night, turned in my rental car. I'm flying to Chicago this morning, and I'm going to do some reconnaissance tonight. I'm doing the game from the booth tomorrow night, Reds and Cubs. And Buster, we are in full pennant race mode. It is so good now.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a bit about that devastating injury to Anthony Rizzo last night. But, Tim, I just mentioned I saw The Who at Fenway Park on Friday night, second row, and it was so cool watching the byplay between Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey. They're giving each other a hard time. I saw Pete Townsend, talking to some of the fans in the front row as he was playing. It was really fun. What was the best concert you ever went to?
Wait a minute. You went to a Who concert?
Yes. Why do you sound surprised?
You're a dork. You don't know anything about music. How can you even understand what The Who is doing? Pete Townsend? Sorry, Buster. You just don't impress me as a music kind of guy.
Wow.
And I'm sorry if that was harsh. Okay. I have been to three concerts in my entire life. I saw Dan Fogelberg in college. I saw Kenny Chesney on the day that we took my daughter to Syracuse. And then I saw Yellow Card, which was a kids band kind of thing, which I took the kids to. A bunch of, seventh grade girls went, 10 years ago or so, and the concert was supposed to start at 7, and Yellow Card, which I kept calling Green Card because I don't know anything about music, they didn't start till 10:30. So I got a bunch of 7th grade girls home at 1 o'clock in the morning on a school night because I took them to a concert. I must have called their parents 20 times to say, I can't believe this is taking this long. I'll get them home as soon as I can. It was so bad. I stink at music. I'm just surprised that you know anything about it, and I'm sorry for doubting you.
I've seen Steve Miller in concert. I've seen the Moody Blues. I've seen the Police. I saw Prince. Come on, Tim. Who are you to critique me? I'm a little if your son Jeffrey, who knows a lot more about music than I do, or certainly you do, were to say something, I would get it. But from you, come on, really?
That's really bad. I just acknowledge I don't know anything about music, and I said basically the same thing to you. I apologize again, Buster. You are much deeper and much more worldly than I'll ever be.
Okay. Well, now that we've settled that, something we both know a lot more about, MVP voting, and, of course, the question popped up yesterday after Mike Trout, the news breaking that he's going to miss the rest of the season with the surgery. I heard you on Baseball Tonight basically say that you think that he's still going to win the MVP. And I have my doubts about that, Tim, because I feel like that we've seen in the voting in the last couple of decades some recency bias. And maybe a great example of that was 2015, Jake Arrieta with the amazing second half. And there were statistically a lot of reasons that year, as you remember, where you'd pick a Zach Greinke, you'd pick a Clayton Kershaw. But the voters went with the guy who was hot at the end. Mike Trout's not going to have that opportunity. Just 20 plate appearances in the month of September. Meanwhile, Alex Bregman is still playing. Marcus Semien still playing for Oakland as they make this great push to the playoffs. I get the feeling Bregman's going to win. If I had a vote, and I haven't voted in this in more than two decades, but if I had a vote, I would vote for Trout because he's far and away the best player in the American League. But knowing how voters do it, I think Bregman's going to win.
Well, we disagree again, Buster. I think the voting has changed to in this respect. We are no longer voting for the most valuable player. We're voting for the best player, and he is clearly the best player, and he has played enough, 600 plate appearances, to say, yes, he's the best player, and he's done basically a full season. It used to be that you really had to carry your team to the playoffs or play in meaningful games all season to win the MVP, and I don't think it works that way anymore, and I'm not real happy about that. I think there has to be an element of this guy carried his team to a bunch of wins and maybe to the postseason, and Mike Trout wasn't going to do that even if he was healthy for the rest of the year. So that's how I think the voting has changed. And yet I think you're exactly right. This is how it should be. If somebody carries their team in the final 2 weeks of the season and has great numbers at the end, that guy should get solid consideration for MVP. But I don't think we look at it that way. I think Mike Trout won the MVP on July the 1st. And I don't think anything is going to change that.
Okay, can we have a bet to be paid off at the winter meetings? Bregman versus Trout. You're saying Trout's going to win. I'm saying I think Bregman's going to win. Again, I'd vote for Trout. And you wouldn't. You would vote for Bregman, yes?
No, I would vote for Trout because I understand how things have changed here. And
okay.
Alex Bregman is not carrying the Astros in by himself. That team is tremendous. That what I'm talking about is a guy like Chipper Jones did in the, when he just carried the Braves past the Mets, I think it was 99, down the stretch to win that division. That's what I'm talking about. I'm just not sure that guy exists in the American League right now.
We saw the Cubs lose Anthony Rizzo yesterday. There hasn't been any clarity about how long he's going to be out, but Tim, I would not expect him to play in another regular season game. I think the schedule is confined enough where the Cubs could overcome this and still get into the playoffs. What's your read?
Yeah, I think they can. This is not a day-to-day thing, Buster. I couldn't even watch it. It was so bad because I can't even bear the thought of watching someone roll his ankle that badly. But if that's black and blue all the way around it, the only guy who ever plays 2 days after that is Cal Ripken, and he was a robot in his own way. I just can't see how Anthony Rizzo is going to be playing anytime soon. The Cubs are already down Baez, but something is going on there. This weekend was ridiculous what they did. I think they can still make the playoffs without him, but it's going to be a much harder road, and it's going to be a difficult spot because they really don't have another first baseman. They could just say, all right, you play first base for 2 weeks. I don't think that guy's there.
A really awful moment for a team that's going to wind up winning its division on Saturday. Charlie Culberson of the Atlanta Braves got hit in the right cheekbone with a 91-mile-per-hour fastball by Fernando Rodney. Tim, it was clearly not intentional, but he just got stuck. Charlie did in the spot where he was at as he squared to bunt. He got hit right beneath his right eye. It was told by sources, the right eye not affected, no concussion, but he does have facial fractures, and he's out for the season. And Charlie Culberson is one of those guys, Tim. He's not a star, but, man, everybody loves him.
Yeah, and that was just terrible. And there are a couple of lessons here, Buster. When you square a bunt like that, you have virtually no chance to get out of the way when a ball is thrown there. The reason you step directly at the pitcher in a non-bunt situation is you can always turn that front shoulder away and get your face away from the ball. But when you square the bunt and you do it properly like he did in a sacrifice bunt situation, you have virtually no chance to get out of the way. And that was one of the worst things. And he's such a valuable player for that team because he can get a hit, he can hit a homer off the bench, he can play the infield and the outfield. He is a great teammate. Johan Camargo is going to have to take over for him if he is healthy enough. And now they're going to have to take Austin Riley and move him around a little bit more to make him a little bit more versatile and a little bit more valuable. So these are two big losses for the Braves. First, Camargo, I saw him get hit in the shin. Oh, my goodness, that hurt so much. And then Culberson's was even worse. I hate to see that. Another reminder how dangerous the game can be and how much that ball can hurt you when it hits you in the wrong place.
Let's look at some of the races, the wild card races. In the National League, at the end of action over the weekend, the Mets 4 games out behind the Cubs in the race for the second wild card, the Phillies 4.5, Diamondbacks 5.5 out. For the Mets last night, as Yogi Berra never said but probably might have said, deja vu all over again. Their bullpen has been an issue all year, and you just have that sense at Citi Field. You know, Zach Wheeler was great on Sunday night, had a 2-1 lead. They turn over the bullpen, and they lose. Are the Mets, Phillies, and Diamondbacks dead in your mind, Tim?
Nobody's dead in the wild card, but those teams are in huge trouble, especially the Diamondbacks and the Mets. They are not going to the playoffs, and every time I see the Phillies, I don't ever see anything that suggests this is a playoff team. So I'm going to say, yeah, the wild card is going to go somewhere between those central teams, Cubs, Cardinals, and Brewers. Two of those teams are going to wild card. The other's going to win the division. That's how I think this is going to go.
In the American League wild card, the team that, look, back in January, Tim, I feel pretty brilliant because I picked the Astros to win the World Series over the Braves back in January. But if I were to take a team off the grid and say, this is a really interesting team, to me would be the Oakland Athletics. They're making a big push at the end of the year, and Shamania, again, outstanding on Sunday, 6 scoreless innings. He's allowed 1 run in 18 innings since he came off the injured list. They are gathering momentum. Look, they're going to have to go through the wild card game, but you would assume, yes, that Manaea has to start that game?
He might. He's been great. And Buster, Jesus Luzardo got the save yesterday. A.J. Puck has pitched some really important innings. They added 3 impact left-handed pitchers to a pennant race late in the season. Nobody else can do that, and this was their hope all along. If we can just hold on until the reinforcements arrive in the manner of power pitching, and they got 3 guys back, lefties, that can get people out. Buster, they've won 11 out of 14. They've won 90 games again. They will pound you if you let them. And now they add the element of left-handed power pitching, not just in the rotation, but in the bullpen. It is really, really impressive what the A's are doing. And nobody's going to want to go to Oakland to play a 1-game series in the wild card because of that place when it's packed. And if they win, I'm not sure anybody wants to play a 5-game series there either.
All right, a lot of good stuff happening for Oakland, but on the other hand, you talk about a team that's collapsed in the second half, the Pirates. Tim, I want to tell you a story. I walked into the Mets clubhouse yesterday. I walked up to a player. I'm not going to use his name, but he was sitting there with his phone. He goes, "Hey, Pirates just moved ahead of the Cubs." And he goes, "Let's see how long this lasts." And immediately, at that point, it was 5-3 Pittsburgh, and sure enough, the Cubs came back with 5 runs in the bottom of the third inning, including this absolutely bizarre play. The Pirates were appealing a play at third base. Their pitcher stepped off the mound, and he was just making a normal appeal. He could have basically walked the ball over to third base, and this is what happened. Give a listen.
Gonzalez standing on the bag, so let's see. Yep, a step off.
Oh, go! He got it! And Kemp will score!
But no, we're going to still go and appeal the play at third base.
Yep, Tim, that's what happened. Lent Casper, Jim Deshays on WGN Sports with that moment on an appeal play at third base. The pitcher threw it away, Tim.
Right, and as we know on appeal plays, Buster, you get one shot to do this. If you screw up the appeal play, if you appeal to the wrong base, believe me, I've seen that. If you appeal to the right base and overthrow like that, suddenly the ball is in play, of course, and you've lost the right to appeal. Even if that play had resulted in a rundown, and the guy had made it back to third safely and not scored, he still would have been safe at third because you blew the appeal play because you couldn't throw a ball from the pitcher's mound to third base in the air. That's why when you do an appeal, the manager sometimes comes out and says, all right, make sure you know how to do this because we only got one shot at this.
It was a microcosm of the Pirates in the second half of their season. What a complete disaster it's been. And lastly, news broke over the weekend. The Diamondbacks have extended the contract of general manager Mike Hazen. This is not a surprise. He'd spent 11 years with the Boston Red Sox. And so when the Red Sox let go of Dombrowski last weekend, there was a lot of early speculation that the Red Sox were going to call the Diamondbacks and say, hey, can we talk to Mike Hazen? I think it was someone in the Diamondbacks front office had basically, Derek Hall, had been quoted as saying, yeah, you know, there's no reason to think that Mike Hazen going to leave. Nice leverage for him, nice extension, and well-deserved, yes?
Right. We talked about this last week, Buster. He's one of the best young executives in the game. He has done a miraculous job with the Diamondbacks, helping keep them in contention while trading away people that he wasn't going to be able to sign, saving an enormous amount of money. And this was a great move by the Diamondbacks because you know the Red Sox were going to come and say, we need you to come back here and help us. And that simply isn't going to happen now. And maybe there's a lesson in this. Maybe he doesn't want to go back to Boston right now, given what a mess that team could be in potentially with Mookie Betts and J.D. Martinez. But that's not the point. The point is the Diamondbacks have something pretty good going there, and Mike Hazen's right in the middle of it, and now they've locked him up for a long time.
All right, Tim, go catch your plane. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, Buster, see ya.
Jessica Mendoza and I got a chance to talk with young Dodger star Walker Buehler over the weekend. Great conversation. When I referenced the phrase snake eyes in this conversation, that's how his maternal grandfather reminded him as a boy to keep his fingers on top of the baseball when he threw his fastball. Turned out to be the perfect advice. I started out by asking him about his longstanding relationship with Will Smith, the catcher who grew up in the same area as he did. Give a listen.
I was thinking you must have a history with Will Smith.
Yeah.
Like, when did you first meet him?
Yeah, I think he was a year behind me in school, so I was probably 15 or 16, and he was probably 14 or 15. You know, they had, like, the little East-West showcase, stuff like that. I remember meeting him there, and then, but back then, he wasn't a catcher. He played infield and then played against him at Louisville. I was like, oh, I remember that guy, and obviously known him now, but... yeah, I've known him for a while.
What's his personality like from a pitcher's perspective?
He's pretty reserved as a guy, which is fine. You know, I think he acts like a pro and he plays like a pro and prepares the right way. So, you know, now it's just about all of us getting on the same page all the time and you know, we're getting better.
When you pitch, do you essentially pitch your own game or you defer to him a lot, follow him?
Yeah. You know, aside from physical, you know, catching and throwing and hitting and things like that, I think one of the catcher's big job is kind of keeping us within our plan as well as adjusting when need be. And he's done a pretty good job of that so far and kind of taking the plan that Honey and I have put together and executing it in the way that it needs to be executed. And, you know, their job is to kind of take the thinking out of it for us, right? Like, we do all this preparation and scouting, and you don't want to run through that on the mound in your head. So that's kind of their gig to think about, and he's done a good job.
So generally speaking, how many times will you shake off during the game?
I'm not a big shake guy. Maybe three or four times, and a lot of times, you know, when I shake, it's just to a certain pitch that I'm 100% convicted in at that moment. But
two strikes a lot.
Yeah, for me, a lot of times it's more just, you know, for some reason or another, I don't want to come off a pitch. I go to a lot of them 50-50, or I just want to throw an off-speed pitch. And if he puts out anything off-speed, I'll throw it. So, yeah, I think I'm a guy that probably shakes less than average.
I like Verducci's piece on you a lot. I'm curious about how he didn't dive into this too much. When the Dodgers wanted
taking you to 24th. You dropped to 24th because of physical concerns. How did that make you feel? Not that the Dodgers took you, but the fact that...
Yeah, I was a little, I don't want to say surprised or shocked or anything like that. I just, you know, when you're dealing with the draft, you feel like you have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, right? And the names and where you fit in. And I ended up, you know, even the day before, thinking completely different than what ended up happening, which it's a draft that happens. You know, fantasy football, you get the guy you didn't think you would. And it's kind of that feeling, I guess. But, I think, you know, most of my career, or college, coming from a pretty successful program, obviously being part of a winning team is something that was important to me. Not that I had any sort of say, but definitely, you know, a little more exciting to go to a good team than kind of a not so successful team.
What was your guess going in the draft about where you were going to go?
Anywhere from 12 to 18. I think as the season went on, that kind of changed. You know, before the season, we kind of had our sights set a little bit higher than that, and the physical stuff kind of stunk. I think, you know, both my draft years, my senior year of high school and my junior year of college, I was hurt. So, at some point, it doesn't really matter, and got into a good organization, and I really couldn't be happier than I am now in terms of where we're at and what team I get to play for.
What do you think the Dodgers do well in terms of being so successful with the draft? It's not like they've had number one pick or number two pick, and they're getting impact players.
You know, I think the one thing that's kind of overlooked, and this is nothing against the Dodgers, I think we do a great job of scouting and finding guys late that can play in the big leagues. I think we do a great job of developing guys. I think at the same time, when you're picking in the 20s consistently, that first-round bust isn't as big a deal as when you're picking 1-1, right? So any guys that we've taken and haven't made it or struggle get overlooked, as opposed to, you know, like the Mark Appel situation where it doesn't work out in Houston.
Yeah.
Like, they're still good, but they had a number one pick. And so then everyone wants to talk about that. You know, I think if you asked the majority of people in baseball 6 months after a draft, they would remember five of the names that were drafted, right?
Yeah.
And when you're picking in the 20s, not many of those names are any of the ones that people remember. So if you have one of those guys like Swanson, if Swanson had not gotten to the big leagues, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But if a guy who's picked 20, like, you know, with Jan Kendall, who's starting to figure it out, but nobody's talking about the Dodgers bust draft pick of, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think it just changes kind of the narrative of it. But at the same time, I do think we do a really good job on, you know, on this team. There's, what, four guys from the 16 draft and three guys from the 15 draft, something like that. So, you know, to turn around that quickly and to have guys that weren't top five picks make it to the big leagues quickly, I think is just a tribute to what we do.
When you learned about throwing a four-seam fastball, that great phrase, snake eyes.
Yeah.
When was the first time that your grandfather brought that up to you?
Man, I can't even, as long as I can remember, that was kind of always what he was telling me. You know, he was big into it. He's from Michigan and loved the Tigers and things like that. And so I started playing baseball, and like probably 8 years old, he ordered like a townhouse kit, you know, and tried to learn as much as he could. And I was fortunate enough to work with a guy named Brad Bohannon, who was a volunteer coach at UK when I was eight or nine, and start working on pitching. You know, I was doing lessons, right, and pretty normal thing around us, and he's now the head coach at Alabama. So, you know, just I had good coaching and people that gave a shit and wanted me to be successful if that's what I wanted to do, and it's worked out so far.
That advice was just perfect. It's a perfect way to think about it if you were a little kid.
Right. So, I like love reptiles too. I think that's where it kind of came from. I don't mean like, I always wanted a lizard or a snake or whatever. Never got one, but.
Snake eyes.
Yeah, so that was, it just, you know, it's funny now, because back then that probably wasn't the traditional thinking, right? It was sink, and so now that it's kind of, you know, spin rate generation, that has kind of led to it, I guess, a little bit, so that was all pretty cool.
Your delivery, like, you've been a little bit soft with Verlander as far as, like,
obviously you're going to get the elevated four seam, but just even, you know, pitching it into the overlay with you two. And it's crazy how similar you guys are with your delivery.
It's funny, you know, I don't. My grandfather was the one, you know, my dad lived in Cincinnati my whole life, so I was with my grandfather a lot, and, you know, I don't want to say, like, he molded me after a Verlander, but I think that's...
Oh, because he's in Detroit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
So I think it probably had something to do with it, or, you know, what he thought it should look like, and things like that, so...
Do you remember watching Verlander?
No, I was a big Reds fan, so, like, I remember Verlander pitching as I kind of got older, but... I was a big Reds fan. I grew up watching, like, Kerrang and Bronson Arroyo and Homer Bailey, Latos, like, Lopez and Cueto. Like, that's who I watched.
Yeah.
So it is kind of funny now that you know, playing in the same league as him, that they're that similar.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz and also leads Cap Talk every week. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, you sent a note yesterday and you suggested we talk on this episode about minor league caps, and you asked about favorites. And so I have a little list here, and I want you to critique my list, okay? First, I'm biased, so I've got the Lake Monsters, Burlington, Vermont.
Of course.
I've always loved the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs logo and Richmond Flying Squirrels, and that's because whoever did that logo, and maybe it was you, man, they found a way to make the flying squirrel look really mean and angry, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, I mean... The rosters have expanded. We can go very deep into this conversation, not as deep as the Red Sox expanded bullpen, but there are so many minor league caps, and they run from the fun to something a little bit more traditional. And I didn't even know you led off with a very strong place to enter the conversation, Buster. I will say my own experience. I did the Brooklyn Cyclones back in 2000 into 2001. They won the New York Penn League Championship. That's sort of a classic look with the Brooklyn Dodgers B. I am actually working on the Wichita AAA club, which is being moved from New Orleans. This is the Marlins' top affiliate as we speak. And, you know, I've got some favorites, too. Some of them are silly. I do feel that I've reached the point in my life that I cannot wear a Montgomery Biscuits hat necessarily. No bacon on my head, anything like that. But there are so many to choose from. What do you got, Troy?
So, like Buster, I am also biased for my number one. The Hartford Yard Goats, of course. Nice. The AA Rockies affiliate. Love them. Two, the Hillsboro Hops. Class
A
of the Diamondbacks.
Yes.
And also, I like the Yankee Short A Class A team, the Staten Island Cannolis.
Which are officially the Yankees, but they veer back and forth between pizza rats and cannolis. And that's another thing that we can talk about here. There has been this just explosion of food-related minor league identities, and that extends to headwear, and hence the idea about having bacon on your head, something like that. So that's been kind of a trend, but they're wild and wonderful and weird. And I distinctly remember back in the early 90s when I believe it was the Carolina Mudcats really captured the public imagination. And it was at a time when more people had access because of just, you know, the way that the stuff was licensed and marketed to more and more minor league caps. They kind of became a fashion statement. And now we have billions to choose from.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You mentioned about, you know, the wave of food related logos that we're seeing. And look, you're a professional. You're the Todd father. I can't imagine how difficult it would be if, you know, a team comes to you and says, "Yes, we'd like to hire you, commission you to come up with a logo built around a cannoli." Well, that would seem to be a special type of challenge. What do you think?
Well, you might actually have to get some cannolis and do some research, which wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I could be down with that in very quick. I would definitely do that. But I recall a conversation, Buster, that you and I had with a major league player who had spent quite a bunch of time in the minor leagues. I'm not going to name this guy's name, but I remember him pulling out a cell phone and showing us some photos of him in a SpongeBob jersey with a matching cap. playing for his team's affiliate. That's all I'm going to say. You do wonder about, I mean, I always do think about the fact that, okay, you know, it is family entertainment. The minors are a very different kind of thing. The players come and go. The uniforms and the team remains. And I think once you get up the ladder to AAA, I always feel like you got to get a little more dignified, but maybe not. Cannolis are good and everybody loves
it. I don't know. I'm wondering. The thing I love about minor league teams is that they're so willing to be flexible for, you know, for one night we're going to be, you know, for example, like the Montgomery Biscuits became the Greenbow Biscuits one day in homage to Forrest Gump. Will there ever be a time where, say, for a game or a weekend, the Royals become like the Kansas City Pork Sliders or something like that? Like, will that ever happen in the major leagues, do we think?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think that the stakes are very different, and the stakes could be actually the Kansas City stakes would be a little sizzle on the diamond there. Look what I just did. I don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, you do see, of course, this constant movement in terms of uniforms. We won't even get into players weekend again. But the minors have to market themselves in a very different way, of course. And I'm not sure you're going to see that.
Yeah, from the Lake Monsters a couple of years ago, to your point, Troy, they had a special logo design. They wore uniforms, the Vermont Maple Kings, which I love because, of course, Vermont has the best maple syrup in the world. Yeah, that was pretty neat. All right, Todd, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys, here we go. The American League Championship Trophy is named in honor of this individual. Is it A, William Harridge? Is it B, Ben Johnson? Is it C, Walter Johnson? Or is it D, Ford Frick? The AL Championship Trophy, William Harridge, Ben Johnson, Walter Johnson, or Ford Frick?
Go ahead, Troy.
Well, I haven't heard of the first two individuals.
That's a knowing laugh, Todd.
25% chance.
Oh, gosh. It's not the Frick Award, because that's for something different, I believe. Is it the second option?
Ben Johnson?
Yes.
The founder of the American League?
Yes, that Ben Johnson.
All right, I got Ben Johnson too.
You're both wrong because it is named in honor of William Harridge.
Darn it.
You're kidding!
American League president after Ben Johnson.
Boy, I thought for sure. I was like, well, of course it's Ben Johnson because, to your point, he was, you know, he's the leader of the American League for years. You know what? Maybe it was all those years hanging around George Steinbrenner where he didn't care about the American League Championship Trophy. He just wanted the big dog, and I don't even remember people talking about that trophy. Oh, man, I felt like what a lost opportunity for me because Troy had no shot.
Wow. William Harridge is looking from the great beyond, admonishing the two of you and threatening you with a suspension for not being knowledgeable.
Yeah, and I should have – the other thing too, Todd, is that once you were to – back up Troy and say, you mean the founder of the American League? It was almost like too obvious, like you were trying to draw him in with a little bit of extra bait to do the second one. Oh, I feel so stupid because Harridge was my second choice in my mind. Man, I feel dumb.
Well, it's not the first time and it won't be the last.
All right. I appreciate it, Todd.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets.
Okay, Buzz, we have some Bleacher Tweets for you this morning after another good weekend in baseball. First one comes from Vince at NotDeFakeVin. Hey, Buster, there was so much hype about Shohei Ohtani being the next Babe Ruth. But after Tommy John and now knee surgery, will we ever see him pitch and hit?
Yeah, Vince, it's interesting you asked that question. A Mets player asked me that very question yesterday in their dugout, and we were kicking it around. Look, next year, absolutely you will see that. The Angels have been devoted to the idea of giving him an opportunity to both pitch and hit. He's shown a lot of acumen, a lot of skills in both, and I think in 2020 he'll continue to try to make that work.
Talked a lot about the Cubs this morning, so Austin LeClaire at BigRen1044 wants to know, if the Cubs don't make the postseason, what problems need to be addressed first? An aging rotation, a consistent bullpen, or added offense?
I don't know if you want to call it a problem or not, but I do think the first order of business is going to be Joe Maddon, the manager. And, in fact, I had an executive over the weekend say, man, if this was like Boston, New York, every day there would be stories about the status of the manager, because you're talking about, you know, a borderline Hall of Fame manager, perhaps nearing the end of his career, especially someone who is historic as Joe Maddon, helping them win the World Series in 2016. Beyond that, I do think it's the aging rotation.
Yes, Joe Maddon's status will certainly be one of the biggest stories of the offseason. CrossFit School Sweat, at School Sweat, he wants to know, is there a team who had a 5 to 7 year run with a core group of 5 to 7 players that was good but never won at all? For me, it's the early 90s Rangers, but this current group of Indians might fall into that same category.
Well, I don't know. You know, I think this is a good Indians team. I don't think it's absolutely loaded. That mid-90s Indians team, wow. I mean, we had a conversation with Kenny Lofton earlier this summer. We were talking about that lineup. I mean, Jim Thome and Manny Ramirez hitting like 6th or 7th, and Albert Bell, you know, 50 homers, 50 doubles, that sort of thing. That team was absolutely stacked, and they came so close to winning the World Series in 1997.
That was always my favorite team to play baseball video games growing up as a kid. Last one comes from
Not surprisingly, that team was awesome.
I know. Last one this morning comes from Ghost Runner on 2nd at Ghost Runners 1. How about showing the Royals a little love? With the team sale becoming official at the end of the season, what do you see them doing at manager and GM?
Well, I mentioned before, I don't know if we're going to see big, massive changes, because they're still going to be a small market team. They'll still be operated like a small market team. Look, Dayton Moore has started the process of turning the team over. You like some of the position player pieces he's put together. We'll see how they do in terms of putting together a pitching staff. I heard from folks with other teams. They think that Mike Matheny, a special assignment scout now working in the Royals organization, whenever Ned Yost decides he doesn't want to manage anymore, the expectation is Mike Matheny would step in and take over next year.
Thank you for the tweets this morning, guys. Keep them coming every day using the hashtag BleacherTweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Walker Buehler and to Todd Radom and to Tim Kirchen and to Troy Farkas, who produced this podcast every day. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.